In Buddhist practice, sound, like everything else they tell you, both is and isn't, has a beginning and no beginning, an ending and no end. Those kinds of ideas and the Buddhist notion of sound have intrigued lots of 20th century composers, and they've also intrigued our correspondent and radio producer Karen Michel, who takes us along to listen to what sound means in both Tibetan and Zen Buddhist traditions.
Rather than luck or hard work or inheritance, it may well be that life is not what you make of it, but what your mind makes of it. I don't know about you, but my mind's way too noisy. It's 7 a.m. mid-November in the mid-1990s in Dharamsala, India, the foothills of the Himalayas. Those mountains a backdrop for this ceremony for His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The three-hour puja is punctuated by horns and gongs and the chants of the dozens of cranberry and mustard-robed monks and lamas. Sound and devotion seem inextricable and omnipresent. One afternoon at the Namgyal Monastery in front of His Holiness's home in exile, instead of the usual sounds in the sanctuary, there's shouting. Rows of monks sit facing each other. Between them, two stand screaming at each other, slapping their hands together and stomping their feet. The Dharma, the teachings, are being debated. Of all possible subjects, the topic is sound. Those hand claps are more than punctuation. It turns out there's a spiritual reason for them, as the one Western monk, a Rangi fellow named Graham, explains.
Down the right hand runs a certain nerve, and down the left hand runs a certain nerve. One of them is the wisdom nerve, one of them is the compassion nerve, yeah? And when you bring them together, crack your hands together, and you stimulate both your kind of wisdom potential and your potential to become compassionate being.
All in a hand clap.
When you're proving that the sound is impermanent, you've got to give a reason why it's impermanent, yeah? And then if you give the reason because it's an object of hearing, yeah? Object of hearing is, we can say, is the definition of sound, yeah? And then what's the fault, if there is a fault, of using object of hearing as a sign to prove that sound is impermanent? And then we're exploring why that doesn't hold as a correct reason. And why it doesn't hold as a correct reason would be a bit technical.
Yeah, more than a bit. When Western artists get turned on by Buddhist ideas about sound, they often seek a guide. The venerable Bardor Tulko Rinpoche is a lead teacher in a monastery in Woodstock, New York. Musicians often see him, looking for a new understanding of the elements of their musical world.
The use of sound in ritual, the sound of liturgy being chanted, musical instruments being played, and so on, is a way of working with our fixation on sound. Primarily, when you are doing liturgical practice, you view the sounds that are being made as an offering. But essentially, what is meant by offering here is a way to purify your fixation. Yeah, there is no inherently existent sound independent from the experience of it.
There are so many Western composers who've taken inspiration from Buddhism. Philip Glass, the Beastie Boys, Leonard Cohen, and John Cage among them. Art critic Kay Larson is writing a book about John Cage and Zen.
His work was entirely about Zen in his mind, Zen and music, and he regarded them as the same thing because, of course, music for Cage was not something composed. It was opening your ears to what is already present, to the music of the world, in his phrase.
Cage wrote that he was attracted to Zen for its mix of humor, intransigence, and detachment. He tested all three in his composition, 4 minutes, 33 seconds. The composer conceived the piece after an experience in an anechoic chamber. There, he wrote, he heard that silence was not the absence of sound, but was the unintended operation of my nervous system and the circulation of my blood. The composition is in three movements. Here's the first part of the first movement. Please note, there is nothing wrong with your radio. What you heard, experienced, labeled with your mind, was whatever was around you. In performance, the musician goes on stage and sits at a piano. No notes are played. Most audiences fidget. Some have even brought in tomatoes and tossed them.
Silence for Cage was equivalent to zero, which was equivalent to emptiness, which of course is equivalent in Zen to the absolute. So silence and the absolute for Cage were the same thing.
It's the cacophony of the mind that composers and the rest of us are trying to shut up, according to Bonnie Miyotai Tracy, the vice abbess at Zen Mountain Monastery, a few miles from Woodstock.
The practice, in a sense, is not eradication. It's not passivity. It's complete being. That complete moment is where you would say sound arises or silence lives. We have such a wonderful chance to take care of the sound of this world and the silence at the heart of it, that it would be a shame for that to seem the province only of those specially trained or particularly called.
For Studio 360, I'm Karen Michelle.